to focus this weekend on really reflecting on what are called the three universal laws or the three characteristics of existence. And earlier on today I've spoken somewhat about this universal characteristic, this universal law of anicca or impermanence. And this afternoon I'd like to speak about the second of these, and the word in Pali is dukkha. And some of you are very familiar with this word and actually with what it means in your own experience. And for some of you this might be a new word, which I'm hoping I can then translate adequately. And even if it is a new word for you, it is certainly not a new experience to you. So I will go into the translation more fully later on, but I understand that the most accurate translation of dukkha is a messy space. So here we address the question of the messy space. So I think if we are to understand the landscape of mindfulness and the landscape of insight, we are really asked to understand dukkha. I think if we're going to really understand compassion, we're also asked to understand what dukkha means and what it invites of us. And I think the awakening of our own heart and mind is truly rooted in the understanding of dukkha. Now, sadly, this word dukkha is often translated as suffering, which I think hardly renders it justice, actually. And what dukkha actually means, I want to go into, but let's first start with this messy space. So dukkha basically describes the unarguable and the non-negotiable thread that runs through all of our lives from the moment of our birth to the moment of our death. This thread of dukkha also runs through the lives of all of those that we love, those that we struggle with, and the myriad of beings that we will never meet. No one is exempt. Dukkha is a thread that runs through all events and experiences, both the lovely and the unlovely are tinged with dukkha. There are no exceptions. Now, strangely, although as we explore this, we will come to see that, much of our lives can actually be dedicated to seeking an exemption. It's all right if this applies to everybody else, but not me. So much of our lives can be spent in these very heroic and dedicated efforts to rearrange the conditions of our lives as much as we can to protect ourselves from dukkha. Almost as if we're trying to construct an illusory island or an illusory edifice in which we are not touched by dukkha, only to find again and again that island dissolving beneath our feet and that edifice crumbling. Now, when we speak about the universal law of dukkha, in a way, it can sound grim, it can sound depressing, and it's primarily because it's been translated inaccurately as suffering is the reason why Buddhism has gained such a bad reputation as being this rather morbid endeavor. It is anything but grim. It's anything but depressing. And I think it is only seen as grim or depressing when dukkha is examined really through the lens of aversion and fear. But when dukkha is examined through the lens of insight and compassion, what we discover is that it is possible for us to put down our arguments, to put down our negotiations, to put down our fears, and in a very real way to align our hearts and our minds with the simple truth of each moment. And this is where compassion begins to grow. This is where understanding and kindness and ease begins to grow. And in truth, I feel that it's only through the alignment of our hearts and minds with the actualities, the simple truths of each moment, in my understanding, this is the only reliable refuge we can actually find. That this is the only steady ground, in truth, the only island we can stand upon in the midst of all things. Now, for the Buddha, the understanding of dukkha came through really just examining his own heart, his own mind, his own life. The understanding of dukkha really came through expanding that field of concern to examine and to look clearly at the lives and hearts and minds of all of those around him. And in truth, dukkha then became the context for the entirety of the path of awakening. It's the context out of which all mindfulness-based applications have developed. And we could say, I think, that understanding dukkha is almost the embarkation path, point of the path. This is where it begins. It begins with our own willingness, just like Siddhartha did 2,500 years ago, our own willingness to turn towards our life and investigate it, understand it, unpack our constructions, unpack our views. Now, this sounds again something that's very simple, doesn't it? But there can be many, many moments in our lives when we don't want to know about dukkha. We're afraid of it. We're afraid of being overwhelmed. We're afraid of being lost. We just don't want to know. And it's perhaps not difficult for us to see the ways in which flight or abandonment of the moment can be such an ingrained habit in our lives. This is what we do with what we can't understand, isn't it? This is what we do with what we fear. This is what we do with what we feel anxious about or ill will towards. We flee. We abandon. But those moments of abandonment, really, it means that we have no access to the understandings that actually liberate our hearts and minds. The understandings that lead to the end of fear and the end of isolation. I think we don't always see the way in which the habits of flight and abandonment rooted in fear actually only magnify fear. So I want to look at the three shades of dukkha, the three nuances of dukkha. Now, the first of these in the text is referred to simply as dukkha-dukkha, double-dukkha. It's really referred to as the pain of pain, the suffering of painful feelings, the experiencing of painful feelings. Now, living in our body, we will all come to know this domain of dukkha, of dukkha-dukkha. It's not an abstract theory, but as a felt experience. In fact, there may be many of you in this room right now who are experiencing the pain of pain. Chronic illness, the sore back, the pain that doesn't go away, the body that ages, and with that experiences its own hurdles and challenges. The way in which our bodies are so affected by external conditions that we can't always control, that affect the well-being of our bodies. Now, none of this, much of this is really not under our control, isn't it? We can't decide not to have the pain of pain. You know, my definition of aging is that the periods of time where everything works well together at the same moment, they get shorter and shorter. Chronic illness in our culture. The average age now where people first experience a chronic illness, the one that doesn't go away, is 60. That's the average age. For some, it's much younger. The average age when a person looks in the mirror and sees their mother or father staring back at them is 32. We see dukkha within ourselves, and we see it all around us. We see that no one is exempt. We have probably all lost people that we've cared for and loved. We've all known the sorrow of grief. This is also within the domain of dukkha, the pain of pain. We've been all asked to face the reality of our own mortality and know that the only thing uncertain about our death is when. And there's a lot of things that we can do with dukkha. And some of these I will go into later. But too often our reactions to dukkha are not so skillful. We fear it. We might buy shares in cosmetic companies. I recently came across an advert for anti-aging cream that shamelessly proposed that aging is optional. By the way, if you do want to invest, apparently cosmetics are a very safe investment. It's a growing field. We're mostly trying to find a way to make it optional. To make it optional for us. And mostly a lot of our reactions, or our primary reaction towards what we don't like or can't accept, is to become forgetful. And there's a tremendous collusion in our culture about forgetfulness. There's a lot of support. We try to find consolation or reassurance. Sometimes we just get busy. This is one of our mechanisms of forgetfulness. We just get busy rearranging the conditions of our lives, really in a sense trying to armor and protect ourselves against not only dukkha, but against also our fears of dukkha and our dislikes. Now, some of our avoidance techniques, I have to mention, are temporarily successful. We shouldn't feel heartened by that, by the way. We shouldn't feel encouraged by that. They are temporarily successful. You know, if I'm really in the midst of something I really feel I can't bear and I switch on the TV or I go to a movie or I eat a piece of chocolate cake, you know, temporarily I think I've scored. You know? I managed to get out of it. But we shouldn't feel encouraged. Because there will come another moment when the uncontrollable, the unpredictable, once more erupts forth into our lives in the form of illness, in the form of grief, the form of loss or frailty. And you know, this path asks us not to wait for the dramatic moments. You know, I really don't think emergency meditation is very effective. You know, I'm going to wait till it all falls apart and then I'm going to find my cushion, you know, and I'm ready now. We're under-resourced. We're simply under-resourced. You know, my friend John Cabazzini, he says, you know, the time to weave your parachute is not when you're about to jump out of the plane. We need to know how to resource ourselves to cultivate a present moment recollection rooted in the body, rooted in the awareness of the phenomenal vulnerability of this body. And, you know, when the Buddha encouraged this present moment recollection, I mean, any of you who are all familiar with the text, you're very aware of how mindfulness of the body, certainly in the Satipatthana Sutta, occupies the biggest section. Because this is where we begin to wake up. Not only to the life of our body, but to the life of all bodies. The life of all things. That this is where we begin to find ourselves at that fork in the crossroads, where we can either deny and avoid and become agitated, or we can turn towards. And the Buddha describes this awareness of our mortality as a kind of sati, a kind of mindfulness, a genuine present moment recollection. In fact, any of you who have ever had any experience with the monastic life would be aware that every morning the nuns and the monks, they get up and they chant the sutta about aging, sickness and death. They chant the suttas about that recollection of mortality. And then we think, well, what does that do to us? Does that make us go into our day thinking, well, it's hardly worthwhile? You know, why bother? You know, this is a dead-end street. You know, does it make us go into our life and into our day thinking, well, nothing is meaningful? You know, nothing is worth giving attention to? I think not. I think it's a recollection, probably the primary recollection, that reminds us to live our life fully. We all think we have a lot of time. We don't know that. Mm-hmm. We all think we might be here forever. We don't know that. But to foster the resilience and the courage and the compassion of our hearts and minds, to firmly plant ourselves in the midst of our lives with all its joys and sorrows. To truly, I think, embrace the recollection of our mortality, I feel this has the power to radically transform our lives. It has the power to radically transform how we go into our days, how we engage with the people that we love, how we engage with the people that we're locked in endless feuds with, how we engage with the people that we don't know. The second domain of dukkha is called Vipawanama dukkha. And this I've already begun to address. It's more than impermanence. Vipawanama dukkha really describes this universal thread, not only of change, but of the instability of all conditions. The innate instability of anything that is constructed, that is built, that is formed, that is born. Now, this too is not news to us, really, is it? I mean, I don't think the Buddha was really talking about much that most of us on some level don't already know. We have a wonderful sitting. We hope it's going to last forever. The next one feels like a disaster movie. We watch a beautiful sunset, hoping we're going to revisit it the next day. It's replaced by clouds and rain. We've all experienced the ways in which people can be unreliable and change in ways that are difficult for us. Is anyone here a stranger to disappointment? When things have not really stayed the way that we wanted them to be, or stayed the same. We lose people we love, and this is just in the human domain. Then we go into the world of inanimate objects. Now that's a puzzler, isn't it? As one philosopher calls it, the malice of inanimate objects. Printers. I need say no more. Computers that break down. Trains that arrive late. Shoes that get holes in them. every moment of our life, we stand on shifting sands of change and uncertainty. And the world of conditions is inherently unstable. Now, Viparinama Dukkha is not a value judgment. It's not about good and bad, about right and wrong. It simply describes the nature of everything that is born, that is constructed, that is formed, that comes into being. Then there is the domain of change that I've already spoken about. Now, sometimes we welcome change. This is not emotionally neutral, isn't it? Sometimes impermanence is fantastic news. Last week I had a root canal. I was such an enthusiastic advocate of impermanence when that was over. Thank goodness, things change, you know? But we tend, of course, to welcome dukkha when it benefits us. When the noisy neighbor moves house, when the hum of the fridge turns off, when obsessive story comes to an end, then we are enthusiasts. But there's a lot of changes we don't feel so emotionally positive towards. Much that changes that we don't welcome, that we meet with fear and aversion. Now, it seems as human beings that there seems to be almost this embedded quest to find stability. The embedded quest to find certainty, to find security, to find this is what we equate with safety, I think. It's what we equate with safety. And we engage in so much behavior which is basically directed towards securing the unsecurable, stabilizing the unstable. And at times, we find ourselves actually engaged in a great deal of clinging, a great deal of grasping, because this is the mechanism that we primarily use to deny change. I'll just hold more tightly. I'll just hold more tightly. And maybe that will prevent the changes that we don't want. And yet we do see, I think, clearly in our own experience, and please just look, I would really encourage you to look at your own experience in this. Does it work? It's not to just put a value judgment upon clinging or grasping, saying it's a bad thing to do, you know, good meditators don't do that, you know. Does it work? Has anybody had the experience that grasping and clinging makes things stay the same or keeps close to us what we want to keep close to us? Possibly not. Possibly not. But that doesn't stop us, actually. It doesn't stop us. And yet what we see is this tension in our life where the very nature of life itself, its changing nature, its unstable nature, is constantly asking us to engage, to be responsive, to align our hearts and minds with it. And yet so often we are doing exactly the opposite. We're arguing, we're battling, we're fighting. We're trying to pretend it is not so. And actually then this leaves us so unhappy and so disquieted. Now, embracing this unsatisfactory, this inherent nature of change and conditions. What does that mean for us? It doesn't mean that it's life denying. In fact, I think it is life embracing. To embrace the reality that we are not actually going to find any lasting consolation, any lasting safety, any lasting refuge within that which cannot be grasped. It's a simple truth. It's a simple truth. Yet it is not an easy one for us to really absorb. It's not an easy one for us to assimilate. And often we don't want to know, and yet we hear the voices within ourselves and we hear the voices around us saying, you know, if you haven't been successful in doing this, you haven't tried hard enough yet. You know, so make more effort. You know, be more strenuous. Be more heroic in the grasping and the clinging and the constructing of the edifices. It's a wonderful, so much wonderful poetry, I think, in the Buddhist tradition that describes the release of that tension. You know, saying life exists amidst a flurry of a thousand ills. How wondrous that we wake up breathing still. How wondrous. Do we feel that? Do we feel that? How wondrous. It's the encouragement, you know, contemplate your mortality for a long time and you will not find it difficult to do that which is helpful, that which is skillful. Contemplate impermanence for a long time, you will not find it difficult to find the heart of compassion. To feel the liberation of it rather than the despair of it. It all depends on the eyes through which we look. I think it's useful to reflect. What would our lives look like? What would our lives look like to live in the spirit of that understanding, and that understanding naturalized in such a way that it's embedded in our bones? That it informs our every word, our every act, our every choice. To live in the spirit of that understanding. In the teaching, you know, the Buddhist tradition is full of teaching stories, and please, they are teaching stories. I hope you don't take a lot of them too literally. But one of the teaching stories in the early life of the Buddha is that we hear again and again as a kind of turning point for Siddhartha. A psychological and a life-turning point was the story of Siddhartha leaving his father's palace where he'd been so protected to embark upon what he later referred to as a noble quest, a noble search for an enduring peace, an enduring happiness, an enduring freedom, a quest for a life fully rooted in compassion and responsiveness. And the story describes a sort of profound understanding that Siddhartha came to when he realized that his status, his comfort, his distractions were not going to ultimately protect him from the winds of change and instability or provide a lasting refuge. Now, I think that we can have a very mixed relationship to these first two domains of dukkha, the pain of pain and the dukkha of instability and change. First of all, they're not news to us. It's not news to us that we can't control the world of conditions. It's not news to us that we are mortal. It's not news to us that we have the choice to have a life where we have only pleasant sights and sounds and sensations and experience. It's not news to us that our very life is vulnerable and lives on shifting conditions and change and could crumble in a moment. Could crumble in a moment. We see this and we know this, but our life is not always guided by our seeing and our knowing, is it? Sometimes I think there can be such considerable dissonance, as I mentioned earlier, between what we know and how we live. Between what we know and how we respond. Between what we know and the values that we exemplify. Now, the story of Siddhartha leaving his father's palace is really the story of him leaving the palace of his illusions. It's not about a physical departure. It's about surrendering that palace of illusions that, yes, he was protected. Yes, he was lived in a certain world. Yes, he was always going to be there. Now, dissonance, as I mentioned earlier, is not something to judge. I think it's a positive discomfort. Because it leads us to question where we've built our own palaces. it leads us to question those areas of dissonance, and where we construct and live in the palaces of our own illusions and pretending. And leaving the palace of our illusions, I think, is not something that entering into a world of bleakness or inertia or passivity. It's not a denial of love. But I think leaving the palace of our illusions is that very place where we truly do begin to put down our arguments with the unarguable. There's a tremendous relief in that. There's a lot more calmness in our life. There's a tremendous release of agitation to put down our arguments with the unarguable, and to find refuge actually in our own heart's capacity for wakefulness, for wholeheartedness, for stillness, to begin to live a life of peace rather than a life of denial. Or rather than a life of avoidance, a life of compassion, rather than a life of turning away. And this brings us to the third domain of dukkha. This brings us to the third domain of dukkha. In the Pali, this is sankhata dukkha or sankhara dukkha. Now, the first two domains of dukkha, the pain of pain, the dukkha of change and uncertainty, these are actually unavoidable. They are not optional. The third domain of dukkha, sankhata or sankhara dukkha, this is a domain where we actually suffer. This is a domain where there's truly anguish. And this is a domain that actually can be understood and can be transformed. And it is this domain of dukkha that is actually the heart of everything that we do here. It's the heart of all insight meditation. Now, sankhara dukkha is our personal narrative. Sankhara dukkha is our personal, emotional, and psychological world that we construct around the first two domains of dukkha. So sankhara dukkha is our argument, we might say. This is our argument. Okay, it's the world of our reactivity, our likes, our dislikes, our fears, our aversions, our anxieties, our judgments, our shoulds, our views. Okay, this is sankhara dukkha. This is the psychological world that's constructed as a reaction, the argument, to the first two domains of dukkha. Now, sankhara dukkha is an agitation. It's the most kind way to put it. It's an agitation. It is always agitated. It's the agitation of our narratives, it's the agitation of our stories, the agitation of our views, and of course, the agitation of our story of me, the agitation of our story of self, how we should be, how others should be, how the world should be. It's the world, it's the agitation of our preoccupations, our obsessions, our ruminations. And sankhara dukkha is also the world of self-construction, the shaping the view of who we are through the reactions that are identified with. Is that clear? The shaping of the view of who we are through our identification with the views, the narrative, and the reactions that we identify with. So go into this a little bit more. Now, perhaps the best illustration of this, and some of you will be very, very familiar with this teaching, the story of the two arrows, okay? Even if you are familiar with it, please listen to it again. So when an untaught being is touched by a painful bodily feeling, they worry and grieve. They lament and beat their breast, weep and become distraught. Thus, they experience two kinds of feelings, a bodily feeling and a mental, emotional feeling. It's as if a person was pierced by an arrow, and following the first injury, they're hit by a second arrow. So that person will experience feelings caused by two arrows. But in the case of a well-taught person, as all of you are, when they are touched by a painful feeling, they will not grieve and lament. They will not beat their breast, nor become distraught. It is one kind of feeling they experience, a bodily feeling, but not an emotional and mental reaction. It is as if that person was pierced by an arrow, but was not hit by the second arrow following the first. So the person experiences feeling caused by the single arrow only. This is the best illustration of Sankhara Dukkha. It's the clearest illustration of Sankhara Dukkha. Now, many of you who are familiar with this story, as awkward as it is, know that it is the primary focus in insight meditation. Now, this passage primarily refers to the painfulness of a bodily injury, the painfulness of a bodily feeling, because this is where we first begin to see clearly, I think, the ways in which Sankhara Dukkha is actually being constructed. You go out the door and you stub your toe. It hurts. Huh? It's dukkha dukkha. It would hurt the Buddha. Huh? Okay? It just hurts. It's that basic, you know, it's that core. Then you see the second arrow winging its way. You know, who put that stone there? Through the school, you know, somebody, I was so terribly unmindful. If I'd been more mindful, I would have seen the stone. You know, I'm going to spend my entire walking period looking out for stones. It goes on and on and on. Can you see the second arrow landing? You see the door opens to your whole history. Your whole life story of mindlessness and the way things, and injustice, you know, the many stones that have come your way, you know. You have a pain in the back. It's the first arrow. It's dukkha, dukkha. And then you see Sankhara Dukkha beginning to be constructed. Oh, that pain in my back. That reminds me when I hurt my back 10 years ago. I remember where that one ended up, you know, 10 years of physio. You know, I know where this is going to go. You know, I know where this is going to go. You know, why has it happened to me? I should have gone to the gym more. You know, if I was a better yogi or better, you know, gym walla, I wouldn't have a pain, sore back. You can see the second arrow just swinging its way. You envisage a life of eternal pain. You know, you stand in the lunch line, my eyes leaning forward, you know, those cookies at the end of the table. It's actually the pain of pain might be the hunger, but boy, can you see the second arrows coming, you know. What if they run out, you know? Oh, what if I don't get there? You know, what if somebody takes them all? I never get enough. You know, it's a story of my life. I will always be the person who doesn't get the cookie. You know? We lose someone we love. We experience dukkha dukkha. We experience the pain of grief. And we see we can indeed move into a world of Sankhara Dukkha, of rumination, of injustice, unfairness. You pass somebody on the walking path, you smile, and you get the meditator's stony look in return. You know? Well, it might be painful to feel that sense of non-return, but can you see the second arrows coming? And the third, and the fourth, you know, and the fifth. A world of arrows winging their way towards us. Now, this is not a life sentence. It is not a life sentence. We learn to sit in the midst of all of this. We learn to live in the midst of this. And the very primary work of mindfulness, the primary work of mindfulness, is to explore and to understand the possibility of severing and cutting the link between the first two arrows and the third. That is the primary work of insight meditation. To sever the link that seems so automatic between the pain of pain, the pain of uncertainty, the pain of loss, and the third arrow of the extra layers of narrative, of reactivity, of fear, of anxiety, and emotional anguish. So mindfulness cuts the link. It's meant to sever the link between the primary experiences of physical, emotional, and life uncertainty and pain, and the underlying tendencies of craving and aversion that are the trigger for the narratives and the stories that are built that lead to distress, that lead to anxiety, that lead to despair. Now, from the perspective, I might say, of evolutionary science, you know, craving and aversion served a purpose. They were survival techniques. Mostly today, these psychological and emotional patterns of craving and aversion are habits deeply rooted in our psyches that don't serve the purpose anymore to protect us. What they do actually serve is the purpose, I think, of leeching joy from our lives. Leeching a sense of wakefulness, leeching a sense of interconnectedness. And often taking us places far from where we want to be. Now, craving is a sankhara. It's a pattern. It's also an agitation. We feel this clearly within our own experience. In the grip of the craving impulse, we're gripped actually by a much deeper underlying view. And it is the view of insufficiency. It's the view of deficit. It's the view of lack that we're trying to fill through the mechanism of craving, of getting, of becoming. So we prowl the world with that view of insufficiency that gets manifested in craving. We tend to prowl the world for more pleasant sights, sounds, experience. Sometimes we crave to be the kind of person who only has particular experiences that are pleasant, that are praising, that are filled with pleasant events. I don't know how, and please don't take this personally, by the way, but, you know, sometimes at Christmas time I have friends. I love them dearly. But I get the round robin letters, you know, and I know my friends have perfect lives. You know, they have the children who succeed, you know, they have wonderful events, you know, they have amazing successes and health, and you know, I have perfect friends. It must be, I must be blessed. And then that is very easy, isn't it, to think, that's the kind of person I want to be. The one where nothing goes wrong, who only has all those wonderful things happen in their lives. We don't want to be the kind of person who would write the letter that says, you know, my kids are failing, my family is troubled, nobody talks to each other, I've lost my job, and I had a terrible vacation, you know, and I'm going to be made redundant. We don't want to be that kind of person. You know, that's another form of craving. We don't want to be that kind of person. So we see these three strands of craving run through our lives, don't we? The craving for the pleasant experience, the craving to be a certain kind of person, the craving not to be another kind of person. All rooted in this kind of underlying view that somehow I am not all right. I am not enough. I am not good enough. I don't have enough. And it's an agitation. It's an agitation that triggers endless thoughts, imagining. It's an agitation that triggers endless agitated behavior, fixing, solutionizing, that's not a word, strategizing, rearranging the conditions of our life. So certainly if we try hard enough, we're going to be that kind of person who has pleasant experiences, who has perfection, who doesn't have everything that seems to remind us, you know, because of not being the kind of person that we think we should be. Aversion and craving are close friends, aren't they? You know, if you think of the three biggest agitations in our life, they're craving, they're aversion, and they're selfing. These are the three biggest agitations in our life. Aversion is a powerful trigger with a very extended family. You know, rumination, jealousy, impatience, frustration, judgment. In fact, it's a really big family. I even think of fantasy as a kind of aversion. You know, it's just I don't want to be where I am. So I'll imagine a better moment. You know, I'll fantasize a better moment. And here, with aversion, we recoil. You know, with craving, it's an approach mechanism. We're moving towards. With aversion, we're recoiling. We're avoiding. We're moving away from. We don't know how to embrace the first two domains of dukkha, of illness or mortality, of change. And so we flee. And so we try to abandon. And it furthers and deepens. It's sort of a self-perpetuating habit pattern. The one of abandonment and flight. It's self-perpetuating and deepening. And we too also see about how the mechanism of aversion truly does exile us, doesn't it? From happiness, from well-being, from contentment, from a sense of sufficiency, and from fearlessness. So what do we do in this path? What do we do in this path? I mean, with mindfulness, we turn towards what we are prone to abandon. It's that simple. It's not easy, but it's that simple. With mindfulness, we turn towards that which we are prone to abandon. We learn to meet this moment as it is with a gentle and with a curious and a kindly touch and to stand upright in the midst of dukkha. And that really means actually standing upright in the midst of our life that brings us sadness, brings us grief, brings us joy, brings us the lovely, and brings us the unlovely. We learn to sense those whispers and sometimes those surges of craving and aversion, and we learn that we can stand upright and not always be lost, not always be overwhelmed. The Buddha said, you know, dukkha is to be understood. Dukkha is to be understood. The causes of dukkha are to be understood. And the cessation of dukkha to be realized. The cessation of dukkha to be realized. And this is really in our hands. As I mentioned this morning in the early text, you know, it talks about breathing in, calming the agitations. It's really calming the sankharas. Calming all of that agitation of craving and aversion and selfing. Breathing out, calming the agitations of craving and aversion and selfing. And it's always a present moment recollection. And I'm really quite sure that we're all aware of the very powerful ways in which craving and aversion are implicated in constructing our world of the moment. Isn't it true? I mean, when we're really lost in craving, how do we see the world? Either as something there to serve us or something there to offer us consolation, something to chase, something to pursue. When we're lost in those impulses of aversion, how do we see the world around us? We highlight imperfection. We see all that is wrong, all that is to be disdained, all that is to be judged. But I'm sure we're also aware of how these impulses are implicated in building the narrative of me. The narrative of insufficiency, the narrative of contractedness, the narrative of incompleteness, of imperfection and unworthiness. In truth, craving and aversion can actually only build a story of an incomplete self. They can only build a narrative of an incomplete, insufficient me. And then we see how many second arrows come with that. The arrows of judgment, the arrows of blame, the arrows of I need, I want, I can't bear, the second arrows of what a failure I am, the story of limitation, the story of imperfection. And doesn't that trigger other agitations? The agitation of trying to become, the agitation of doubt, the agitation of fear, the agitation of numbness, and of course all revolving around this primary agitation of me, the story of who I am. Have you noticed how the story of me, the agitated me, very rarely builds around the wholesome or the skillful? Have you noticed in moments when you're feeling pretty calm, pretty spacious, you know, very balanced, steady, there's not a whole lot of narrative around it, is there? You know, why am I so calm? Yeah. Shouldn't really be happening. You know? Why am I so compassionate? Oh, there's something wrong with that picture. You know, it doesn't happen, does it? Have you noticed that the bigger the narrative is the degree to which it's related to the highlighting and the identification with imperfection? With what is unhelpful. In fact, it is very hard to find any sense of a solid or substantial I outside of the patterns of aversion, craving, and identification. Now, we add a lot of blame to that. You know, meditators are better at it than anybody in my experience, you know. I mean, before you began practicing, you just went through life accepting that you're a solid self. Even though you couldn't quite find yourself, you were sure it was hidden there somewhere, you know. And then you get this teaching that maybe you're not quite as solid as you thought you were. So we do a lot of blame around craving and aversion and selfing and holding. And we tell ourselves we should let go. We tell ourselves we should let go of our stories. We should let go of our obsessions. We should let go of craving. We should let go of aversion. And we despair, actually. Many meditators despair when they find that this inner commanding is not very effective. You know, so they just shout louder at themselves. You know, just let go, let go, let go, you know, let go. I really need to let go, you know. I really should let go. They just shout louder at themselves without actually questioning why it is so ineffective. You know, is it very successful for you? You know, shouting at yourself to let go? In those moments when you're aware that you're really holding something really tightly, you know, you're shouting at yourself, renunciation's really good here, you know, I should just like, it's not that, it doesn't work that well, does it? Have you actually questioned why it is so ineffective? Personally, I don't think we should be surprised at all. I think this is a really good insight. You know, what's really amazing to me is that if we think of the idea of self as a pattern, a construction, then we're a sankhara. Then we're imagining that one sankhara is going to let go of another sankhara. Tell me how that one works. Tell me how that one works. That one sankhara is going to let go of another sankhara. One pattern is going to let go of another pattern. Does that compute for you? So don't be surprised. Don't despair when your commands to let go have been utterly unsuccessful. It's a wake-up call. It's a genuine wake-up call. It's interesting because this idea, it's a genuine wake-up call. Breathing in that asks us to question the autonomy of I. Asks us to deeply question the autonomy of self. breathing in, calming the formations, breathing out, calming the formations, moment to moment, with mindfulness, with investigation. And, you know, the agitations do begin to calm. We start to see the possibility of putting down the arguments with the unarguable, aligning our hearts, aligning our lives with the simple truths of each moment, with the way things actually are. We start to cultivate the conditions that allow for letting go. The conditions that allow for letting go are truly the conditions of calm, the conditions of spaciousness, the conditions of calm. These are the conditions of non-clinging. This is within our hands, the cultivation of those conditions. As that calmness begins to deepen, I think life reveals itself to us. We do see the unarguable nature of these three universal laws, and we begin to really see that the path to peace is to live in the light of those universal laws, rather than apart from them, or separate from them, or disconnected from them. This is where we actually discover a heart and a mind that is truly a friend, that is truly a refuge. This is also where we begin to discover, I feel, that possibility of a compassion and a kindness that can embrace all lives, equally held within this web of these universal laws. I think the great, for me, one of the great gifts and the great teachings of the Buddha is the understanding that we are never helpless. The teaching to be a conscious participant in the making of our world of the moment. I want to end, I'd like to share with you a poem, some of you may know it. It's by a poet called Fernando Pessoa. It's from a book of poetry that's titled A Little Larger Than the Entire Universe. Very modest title. It's called A Bend in the Road. Beyond the bend in the road, there may be a well and there may be a castle, and there may be just more road. I don't know and don't ask. As long as I'm on the road that's before the bend, I look only at the road before the bend, because the road before the bend is all I can see. It would do me no good to look anywhere else or what I can't see. Let's pay attention only to where we are. There's enough beauty in being here and not somewhere else. If there are people beyond the bend in the road, let them worry about what's beyond the bend in the road. That, for them, is the road. If we're to arrive there, when we arrive there, we'll know. But now we know only that we're not there. Here, there's just the road before the bend. And before the bend, there's the road without any bend. We take just a moment quietly together, and then have some time if you have any reflections or questions.